Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, as always, and today I'm joined by Dr. Saul Smilensky. He's a professor at the Department of Philosophy at the University of Haifa in Israel. He works primarily on normative and applied ethics, the free will problem, and the meaning of life. He's the author of Free Will and Illusion and the book we're going to focus on the most today, 10 Moral Paradoxes. So, Saul, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. So, I mean, what are moral paradoxes, just to start off with?
Well, I guess moral paradoxes are first of all paradoxes, and then they deal with ethics. So broadly, I mean, ethics, we can take it in common sense terms. I mean, basically, the rights of and wrongs of the ways we should treat other human beings or something like that. Now, paradoxes are usually taught to be, in philosophy, they're usually taught to be arguments where if you have we have certain assumptions, certain beliefs, and then a process of argumentation, and it leads to a conclusion. And the conclusion is absurd. So that sort of thing, the idea that we have something that in some way is absurd, but that we might have, or it seems that we have good reason to believe could be the case, but in morality, as applied to morality.
But being absurd in this context, what does it mean exactly? Does it run counter to common sense, or what exactly?
Okay, so here it gets interesting. I mean, normally in most areas of philosophy, and paradoxes are very big in most areas of philosophy, not in ethics so much, but for interesting reasons, I think. But in most areas of philosophy, in epistemology, theory of knowledge, logic, philosophy of science, metaphysics, other areas, they're really big. And usually they're taught to be, the absurdity means that we've made a mistake. So that the conclusions only seem to be okay, and the argumentation leading from the assumptions to the conclusion is probably has some mistake, or at least either the assumptions or the argumentation, or both, of course, are mistaken. Otherwise, we wouldn't reach absurdity. And some of the moral paradoxes I discuss, some of the moral paradoxes in general, and some of the ones that I've thought of or discovered, do have that form. But also, I think something even more interesting is going on. I think that part of what's going on is that we have what I call existential paradoxes. And in an existential paradox, we reach absurdity, but it's not a mistake. The mistake, if you want, is in reality. So, reality sucks. It's not us. We're smart enough. We're figuring out what's going on. So the assumptions are okay, the argumentation is fine. And the absurdity is not a mark of falsity, but it is some dissonance between what we expect about life or rationality or morality or human life. And thus, it's the paradox here is not some mistake that we have to run back and see where we've made an error, but actually it's a discovery. So the more paradoxes we discover in some sense, if they're genuine existential paradoxes, then we've made actual discoveries about reality, about moral reality, and moral life.
So we can say that there are different kinds of paradoxes, right? Like, for example, moral paradoxes, scientific paradoxes, existential paradoxes, and so on.
Sure, yeah. I mean, first of all, there are paradoxes in different areas, in different areas of life, and for example, in science and in philosophy, but also within philosophy, I'm focusing on moral paradoxes and meaning of life paradoxes, you might say. But within, if we try to classify the paradoxes, some of them are more traditional forms, as I said, whereby we have some sort of an error which we need to discover. And the paradox is like a flag that tells us, look, something's wrong is going on here. But I'm suggesting that sometimes in moral life and sometimes in human life, what happens is very different, that actually the absurdity is a discovery. It's something we uncover. It's not a mistake that we have to go and correct.
Right. At a certain point there, you mentioned that you discovered some of these paradoxes. So, are paradoxes something that philosophers usually deal with, or is it an area that is somewhat neglected by them?
Well, here I think there's a difference between the fields. In a way that, as I said, I think is interesting, in many areas of philosophy, in logic, philosophy of mathematics, metaphysics, philosophy of science, other areas, there are a lot of paradoxes, and they're very widely discussed. And there are books about coming out all the time, and PhDs and articles, and there's a lot, there's the whole industries about from going back to the Liar paradox. I mean, we have over 2,500 years of philosophical discussion of paradox. On the other hand, in the moral sphere, not that much is going on. Derek Parfit is one figure, a very prominent figure, arguably the best, more the most, I would say at least the most interesting moral philosopher, perhaps since Kant. And he is well known for uncovering some moral paradoxes, and there are a few others that have been discussed, but mostly the field has been neglected. And I think there's something special about morality that people, I mean, some people are skeptical about morality on the meta-ethical level in general. But if you're not skeptical, if you don't think that, that the whole thing is nonsense, then people tend to in a way, take things too seriously, to be less playful. To think that they kind of, I think we shy away from the paradox, from the more immorality, because it's sort of dangerous, it's socially dangerous, it's personally threatening. Maybe it means that it might cause too much skepticism among people. So I think we're hesitant. In general, people are hesitant, even philosophers are hesitant to touch these areas, the sensitive areas. And I think it's a problem because basically we want to try philosophy as we are lovers of wisdom. So we should try to understand what's going on, really, and figure it out.
So you said that there are people that are skeptical about morality. Does that are you referring to moral relativists, to moral nihilists, or what exactly?
Perhaps, yeah, and other forms as well. I think I don't really go into those areas. I mean, I kind of assume my discussion, like all in all philosophy, we have to start somewhere. And I mean, the story is that nobody knows about the greatest skeptics that ever lived because they never said anything. Because if you are saying anything, you're already not a real skeptic. I mean, because you assumed people understand what you say, etc. So in some sense, we start in the middle. And I don't ask myself what's called meta-ethics so much. I mean, I assume that morality is not nonsense. That there is, it's not just a social construct. It's not just that anybody can decide what's right and what's wrong. But that there are actually things that are right and are wrong, and things that there. It makes sense to say that some things are good and some things are bad. And once you assume that, you go into what's called in philosophy. It's called normative ethics, and into theories, into trying to understand specific cases. And there, I think that the neglected philosophical paradoxes can be very fruitful. They can open new areas and new avenues for our thinking.
So let's talk about at least some of the moral paradoxes you present in the book. First of all, you talk about misfortunes. Could you tell us what misfortunes are?
Sure. I thought I, there's a general. I think there's a general. Here, I don't think it's quite a discovery, I offer an analysis, which strikingly and surprisingly doesn't really exist philosophically. I mean, the idea that some things are seem like great misfortunes, but then they turn out well, are common. We know about this from real life. We don't need the philosophers for this. It's commonly thought about as a fortunate misfortunes. But I think it causes great perplexity philosophically. And I mean, we shouldn't really think about small cases. For example, you break your leg and then that's a misfortune, and then but then you go to the hospital, and then the doctor takes care of you. It happens to be your the love of your life, so it was a misfortune, but obviously it was good fortune, because otherwise you wouldn't have met her. Now that's not a real misfortune. It seems, and all considered. We are the cases I'm trying to think about, I think we should think about, are cases where things are really awful. So being born with significant disability, a difficulty walking that then gets corrected over many years by, you know, one of the cases I describe is of an Olympic swimmer, but who was born into a very difficult situation where she had difficult breathing and difficult walking. And then she trains herself at great effort, and her life is incredibly hard. Much harder than the lives of anybody in her environment. But then this brings her to achieve great things, which through sport in this case, but it doesn't have to be sport, of course. And achievements, it's necessary that the achievements would not have, that we have good reason to think, and that she would think also, that they wouldn't have achieved, she wouldn't have reached so far. Has been so successful and so happy with her success, except for the misfortune of the early years of her childhood. But the childhood also has to be very, very, as I said, very, very difficult. And she has to say that it was worth it. I mean, she has to say that she wouldn't give up all the success if you would have given her a happy childhood. So then, how do we interpret this? What do we do with this? Do we, for example, want to say that it wasn't a misfortune? It just seemed like the misfortune, because in the end, it made her life better, and she agrees that it was worth it. But that seems not really persuasive and cruel, because it was such an awful thing. I mean, we wouldn't wish our enemies, certainly not our children, to have such hardship and misery and suffering and uncertainty that they would lead to anything better in our childhood. It was a terrible, very difficult childhood. So it seems like an obvious misfortune, but then it turned on the basis of that, for example, because it built her character in unusual ways. It led to her life being so much better. So was it a misfortune? Was it a good fortune? Or perhaps it was both in some sense, but what does it mean to say that it was both a misfortune and a bad fortune, a misfortune and good fortune? So anyway, so that's the first paradox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, just to make this clear, should we analyze something and say that it's a misfortune or is good fortune at different time periods? Because I would imagine that when something bad happens to someone, at least in the moment, we would say it's a misfortune. But then if down the line it leads to good consequences, then we would have to go back and say it was good fortune.
Right. Well, I think that can work in many normal instances where you say, well, that was the price of learning or growing up, or I gained something from all the hardship. But in very extreme cases, there's a famous case of Primo Levi, who said that who was in Auschwitz. And he actually said that in some sense, the experience there made his life better. It made him a writer. He would otherwise not have gone and made his life a witness, and he made his life better. But that we don't really want to say, well, okay, then you were really lucky that you were put in Auschwitz. I mean, that doesn't seem persuasive. So something problematic is going on here, and we need to try to interpret it. And it's not easy, because and that's part of the nature of paradoxes in general, that we have at least some forms of paradox, an antinomy, where we have two sides. On the one hand, it seems very persuasive that these were terrible things. It was a terrible mountain. They were just thrown into life to swim, or metaphorically to swim or drown. And without any real choice, except nobody, and without any much help necessarily. And so it was a terrible misfortune. You wouldn't wish it on anybody. It was clearly a terrible thing, not something you choose to do. Okay, I'll have a course of training in order to improve myself. On the other hand, if you agreed that it made your life much better than it would have been otherwise, and that it was worth it, then maybe it wasn't a misfortune. So I think we're torn between the two interpretations. And it remains paradoxical. And even if we opt for one, even if we opt for the idea that, well, in the end, it wasn't a misfortune, it was good fortune, because sometimes these cases are so terrible, as I said, as the example I gave Auschwitz, but of course, many other examples can be given, Even if we say, well, it was good fortune, but that seems still seems paradoxical because I mean, imagine what are we saying here? We are saying that Primo Levi was lucky to be put in Auschwitz, and that seems paradoxical. Even if it's convincing in some sense, it's still paradoxical. It seems something. The sense of absurdity, I think, would remain here.
Right. So another paradox is the paradox of beneficial retirement. Could you tell us about it?
Sure. Yeah. This is, I think, interesting theoretically, and also it has quite a lot of significance in real life. And that's something. So I'm happy that I thought about this paradox. I don't know how influential it can actually be because a lot of people have a tendency to deceive themselves and might not follow through with the implications. But I think it is. I think it's a significant, if I may say so. It's a, in a way, it's a significant discovery. And there have been some philosophical and non-philosophical responses to it in that were already published. The idea is quite simple. I'll speak about myself again. If I am not terrible, let's say I'm a medical doctor. It's always easy to pick on the doctors because they do important things. Let's say I'm a medical doctor and I'm not terrible in this, and I don't actually do harm. So when I go to work, I do good by and large. And if I don't come in a certain day, nobody replaces me, that's a problem. I mean, they would wish me to come to work. So it's not because others, it's too easy if I actually do harm. On the other hand, I'm quite mediocre. I'm actually, let's say that three quarters of the, of I'm three quarters of the other doctors in my field, in my area, and where I work are better than me. And so I'm in the lower quarter of medical doctors in the relevant field. Now, if I would retire, let's assume that there are good replacements outside. It might be new immigrants, it might be young students that are finishing medical school and within a few years will be up to date and will be good. And that if I would retire, then whoever replaces me with almost certain we can be almost certain about this, will do a much better job. Now, this means that he'll diagnose patients better, he'll prevent a lot of suffering, and he'll save lives. Okay. Actually, I started with myself, but then I moved to somebody else. That's interesting psychologically. Anyway, so let's see, get back to myself. So I'm this doctor. And I notice, on the other hand, I wanted to be a doctor since I was a child. That was my dream. I studied very hard for it, and then I worked very hard as a beginning apprentice doctor. And it is my life. It's not only my earning, but it is my identity, and my family is proud of me. And I would really lose a great deal if I was to or want to retire. So, but then this brings up the question, should I retire? Now we can, normally we can, I mean, naturally we can think about it as a consequentialist question, like in utilitarian terms. Would the world be better if I retire? Clearly that's true, but that's too demanding. I mean, clearly it's true because if I retire, somebody much better than me would replace me, and he would save more patients that I otherwise might suffer and die. But that's too quick because, if I sold my car, and rode the bus and gave the money to charities working with starving people in the third world or whatever, I could also do much more good in this. But we don't expect people to make huge sacrifices in this way. So, but the unique form, I think, of the paradox here of beneficial retirement is that it doesn't fo focus on maximizing good states of affairs. It doesn't focus on making do with it. I have some obligation to sacrifice my well-being in order to make things better for other people, which is a very strong argument, but therefore it's a weak argument in the sense philosophically because it's too demanding. We don't really think that that's what, hardly anybody thinks that that's what we should do. So my argument is that the crucial concept here is integrity. So the problem is that if I want to be a doctor just because I want to walk around with a white coat and I like making a lot of money, then that's fine. But if I became a doctor because I care about people, I want to, I mean, I also care about making money and about my reputation, etc. But that's fine. I mean, we don't expect people to be saints. But if I also, it's enough that I also care significantly about helping people, but not about my helping people necessarily, but about people's health. I care that people not die, that people not suffer. Once I realized that if I only would leave, somebody much better than me would replace me, and he would prevent the suffering and save the lives of many people that I'm not good enough to do, then how can I live with myself and not retire, not leave? And we're assuming here again, we're assuming that, you know, me and my family, we won't starve. There's some option that I can do and other things I can do in life. So I think it's a very strong dilemma, because if we say you should retire here, you should leave and give somebody else a chance to replace you, then that's extremely demanding, except in very radical situations like wartime. We don't expect people to do something that strong, it almost seems heroic. On the other hand, because what's at stake here is our integrity, then if we don't, then that means that morality here says, oh, that's okay, you can live without your integrity. So it's not only psychological, it's a question about how demanding morality has to be. And I think there's something special about the notion of integrity here that in a sense forces us to retire. If we think, and there might be good reasons to think that that many people, most people who the case applies to, would not retire, then, you know, maybe we shouldn't know about this, maybe we shouldn't tell people that, but that's again begins to get into paradoxical territory. And just one more thing I want to point out here, this is a very central, this is very very widely prevalent. So there are many, arguably half the people are more or less below average. So, and in many fields, sometimes there's shortages and there are not enough people in a certain field. But normally, in many cases, there are actually quite a lot of, in a way, spare people outside that are ready to replace you if you retire. And in that case, so I think the dilemma is very, very strong. I mean, we think about people in extremely important positions who are sitting in a place where they don't positively do damage, but just because there's somebody better outside that would replace them, the question is whether how much should they mind about that.
Mm-hmm. Right. So a thing that usually goes associated with morality is punishment. I mean, we want to punish wrongdoers, but are there any moral paradoxes associated with punishment?
Well, there are some of them, some that are known, and I have discussed two of these. One of them, I don't know if we should actually get into it, because it's quite complicated. So I'm wondering, but maybe the second one would be better for us to get into, and that's the part, what I call the paradox of non-punishment. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, but if you would want, we might discuss the other one. There are plenty of them here. This is, my book is it's called 10 Moral Paradoxes. So we probably won't be able to do all of it. Anyway, the paradox of non-punishment is actually quite fun, and it's easy to explain. I mean, one way to tell the story is is the way how I discovered it, how I thought about it. I was visiting somebody in London some years ago, and he told me that I should, whatever I do, I should find a legal parking place, so that if I and not stand somewhere where it's not absolutely permitted to park, because the London traffic policemen are quite cruel, as it were. And even if you're just standing there, they won't give you a fine. They would actually drag your car, have your car dragged to some far distant place in the other area, in some other area of London. So in a way, the punishment is disproportional. Because it's not like you're blocking a major artery in the city, but you're just parking and not really harming anybody. But still, you would get overpunished, as it were. So that, and actually it proved right. So I circled close to an hour before I found a completely kosher parking place. And but then while I was doing that, that led me to think about what does this mean philosophically. So that led me to the thought that, well, actually, sometimes we can threaten people with punishment that if we execute it, if we actually carry out the punishment, would be unreasonable, would be cruel and unacceptable, because it would be disproportional, be much too strong, and nobody would deserve that strong a form of punishment. However, if the punishment is so strong, it might well be, in most cases, in almost all cases, perhaps in all cases, in certain areas, in certain fields, it wouldn't apply everywhere, but in certain instances, it might be the case that we would have perfect deterrence. And then the question is, can we really think about doing so? Because actually, if we have perfect deterrence, then nobody would get punished. And therefore, obviously, logically, nobody would get unjustly punished. On the other hand, the idea of threatening, certainly the state threatening with punishment that is unacceptable and unjust, is also unreasonable. So there's this dilemma here whether we can make something of it. And so it seems that in some sense, the current situation where we have low deterrence, and therefore we have punishment, and therefore sometimes you punish even the innocent, and also there's even in the punishment of the guilty there are some difficulties, and the whole thing seems a mess. The whole situation seems a mess. And here is this idea where perhaps we can threaten with something that, you know, if you look at nuclear deterrence in the global sphere, then that has that form. But we don't apply it, and it actually works, at least so far. Hopefully it will continue to work, and it has been working since World War II. But the question is whether there are certain corners of our moral life where we might apply it. And if we say no, we should never apply it, then that's interesting, because that means that we are actually, in some sense, we're paying a high price. We are continuing, because we care so much about the idea of the state not threatening with unjust punishment, we actually, it means that we have to engage in punishment, which does involve some injustice quite frequently. And we're not tempted by the idea of not having to punish anybody because you threaten him so effectively that he then doesn't have to, he doesn't commit anything and then the crime, and then he's not, he doesn't have to be punished. Anyway, so that's right.
So, and when people live in unfavorable circumstances, should we consider that as a factor in punishing them? Should it be a mitigating factor, for example?
I think so. I think there's strong intuitions here. Yes. But then also, once we say that that's connects to one another of my paradoxes, that if we say that people should be, there's some complications here, but just trying to do this briefly, if we say that we should, there are mitigating circumstances that apply to people because of their childhood, they had difficult surroundings, there were a lot of temptations around them, or they had bad role models because they grew up in bad neighborhoods, etc. So we should punish them less. But also frequently those situations harden them, make them more difficult to deter. So therefore, in pragmatically, in order to deter them, we need to punish them more severely. So that leads to, I mean, these might be a bit complicated to explain briefly, but I think people might look at the book itself, but I think it turns out that this is not the special and in a way sort of curious case of the paradox of non-punishment, where you threaten with too much punishment. Here, this applies to actual real systems of punishment. I think that there are two paradoxes that that apply here because of the tension between the fact that the people who deserve less punishment because they're mitigating circumstances, for example, in the circumstances where they grew up, are also frequently the same people who need to be deterred by more severe punishment in order to be threatened. So in a way, the more the more you need to be threatened in order to, for the punish for the threat to prevent you from committing crimes, the less you deserve to be punished. And that's, I mean, people are complicated, so I don't, it's not quite a Newtonian law here, but still, it gets very, very quickly, it becomes very absurd.
Yeah. So earlier I've asked you about misfortunes, and usually when we notice or witness a misfortune, we feel sorry about it. But should people always feel sorry when bad things happen?
Okay, the paradox here, I think, is I mean, of course, I argue not, because otherwise it wouldn't be interesting. We wouldn't be talking about it. So I think our listeners can guess where I'm going here. Now, of course, this is not the general claim. In general, we should be sympathetic and of course to people and to when they suffer, etc. But there's a specific claim here that sometimes in certain circumstances, even in circumstances where we actually gain by egoistically ourselves, when bad things happen to people, it's okay, it's permissible not to be sorry that the bad things happen, that the morally bad things happen, and even we might be happy. And here again, I might tell a story from my own life just to make this, to illustrate this, I think. And this is also lies behind the reason why I thought about how I thought about this paradox. I mean, it just so happens that I have an older brother. And between my older brother and myself, there's quite a distance of some years. And in the middle, there was a baby was born. There was a baby girl who was born and died when she was 3 weeks old. Now, am I sorry that she died? Okay. Well, I mean, I think morally it would have been better had she lived on because she had some basically illness or something, heart deficiency when she was born. It would have been better because she was a person already, she was living, and I was non-existence. I mean, my not having been born cannot really be, now that I'm alive, I care a lot about being alive, and hopefully some other people. But before I was born, it doesn't make much sense to say that it was morally bad if I wouldn't have been born. Because there, you know, there are an infinite, almost infinite number of cases of people who might be born every time. You know, people might have sex; they might, you know, have children. Very depending on, you know, situations. So there's an infinite number here. So basically, when a child, a human person, a person who is alive dies, that's morally bad, but in itself. But as a result, I was born, and otherwise with certainty, I wouldn't have the fragility of how people come to be born. This is related to what's called the non-identity problem. Just in case somebody wants to look it up, the non-identity problem, which is related to Dirk Parfit and his work, which I mentioned. It's something that I've also done some work on. But without getting into all these complications, just about this situation, had she been born, it's not that I would have had a sister, but I wouldn't have been born. Actually, in real life. So am I sorry that she died? Well, I'm sorry. I think I should say that I'm sorry for her. I mean, it's you know, for her. Poor girl, she died. Poor baby. But on the other hand, all considered, am I sorry about the state of affairs where she died and I was born? No, I'm not. And I think it's perfectly legitimate for me to say that, I mean, I think it would be really in bad taste if I had a party. But about this, but quietly being saying, well, that's life. It's a sad aspect of life, but I'm very happy that I was born, that I'm alive, and enjoy life. And therefore, if the price, as it happens, was that she would die, then I think that while objectively perhaps somebody from the outside would say, well, it would have been better had you lived, and you wouldn't have been born. I think it's too demanding to expect this for me. And this applies to many other examples, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting the example you mentioned because it reminded me of David Benatar and antinatalism and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So, first of all, is there a moral obligation to have children?
Well, I think by and large we have to say no in almost every case. I think that it is possible. This is from more from previous work, not so much from this, the Moral Paradoxes book. But I think in certain circumstances, there might be an obligation to have children, given certain assumptions about. I mean, obviously, there's a great responsibility in having children. You have to take care of them, and you have to be ready to do so, etc. Both psychologically and in other ways, you have to be a mature person, for example. But I think in certain circumstances, there might be quite a strict obligation, and at least to try, or at least to think about it very seriously. And in any case, I think there's some, because I, unlike Benatar, I think that life is very often good for people. And I think his empirical claims here about life's badness for most people are not just not convincing. I've written about this on certain occasions, and some other people have attacked his arguments in that way. And I'm not very impressed. I mean, I think his work is very interesting, but I'm not overly impressed with the asymmetries and with all the specific philosophical arguments he said why we are obliged not to bring people into the world. So therefore, I think because life is good, and so I think that it makes sense to say that, just to summarize very briefly, I think it makes sense to say that life is a gift, and that if certain conditions apply, I think that we are actually good by doing so, by bringing people to life, not without limit, and not if we very much don't want to do it, and except in very unusual circumstances. So obviously there need to be certainly great limitations here. An excellent philosopher called Rivka Weinberg has recently written a book that listeners might look at, and that actually considers these issues, and I think makes sensible points. So I think I don't think we should go too extreme here, but certainly I would not accept. I don't think we have philosophical reasons, and I think we have to accept Benatar's arguments. And I think that empirically, his perception of what actually goes on in most people's lives, at least people who are not very unfortunate in their life circumstances, is just not convincing.
Mm-hmm. So another thing that you explore in your work is moral complaint. What is this about?
Okay. Moral complaint is another topic which surprisingly has been quite neglected by philosophers. But I think it's getting some more attention. I think it's something... I think interesting things are going on there, and I think that it's really worth thinking about seriously. When we complain morally, we think that we can expect certain things to be done to us or not done to us, and then our expectations are not fulfilled, and it often has a connection with resentment. That we think that because we're not treated as we should be treated, we have cause for resentment, and also for expectations from other people, from other good people who say hear about what's going on, that to have sympathy for us and perhaps even to assist us, that might require other assumptions here, and so basically when we complain, we are saying that things are not as they should be. And that we are the victims. Let's assume that the cases are about us ourselves. We are wronged. We're treated badly. We're treated not as we should be treated. And we in a sense we are calling for help, or we're calling for things to be changed, or at least we're calling for people to notice us and to see that we have been wronged, and perhaps to condemn the people who have been mistreating us. Something like that. And the specific cases I discuss are in one of the paradoxes, in one of the chapters in my 10 Moral Paradoxes book, is the paradox of moral complaint, concerns the case where I complain about being wronged, but I am a person who previously has done a similar thing. So, for example, it might be a very bad very extremely bad thing, and might, I mean, might be a terrorist who is complaining about when you know, his family is then a terrorist trying to kill people, who then complains about people he then cares about back home who are killed. But we don't need to go to the extreme situations. We can think about, you can think about the common, familiar from daily life situations that we all encounter. I mean, people who, for example, people who gossip about others, people who regularly are known to be heavy gossipers about others. But then when somebody gossips about them, they said, oh, how can you do such a thing? That's terrible. That's awful, etc. Or people who are notoriously late to meetings with other people. And others know that they can't expect them to come on time because that's how they are. But then when somebody pays them with the same medicine, as it were, and doesn't, it comes later. If they would come in and rebuke him and say, oh, but we said that you would arrive at 2 o'clock, how come you're 15 minutes late? So I think in these sort of cases, it seems absurd to complain, okay? How can you complain about when people treat you in a way in which you normally, when without any excuse, treat other people. But then this again, we have, I think, a form of an antinomy here in many cases. It doesn't have to be in all cases, but in many cases. Because if we think about serious, particularly about serious situations, then this becomes a problem. Because normally we think that people should not be wronged. For example, their human rights are not met, and they're unjustly punished, or other situations that might, you know, police violence or things like that, which are very worrisome. Certainly, we want to say that if you are wrong, then you have a right to complain. On the other hand, if you are normally, habitually, and without excuse, you yourself treat people, wrong people, in quite similar ways, then how can you complain? I mean, why are you better than other people? You, as it were, I think you lose the moral standing. You lose the moral baseline from which you can condemn others for treating you wrong, for wronging you. So there's, I think the antinomy here, paradox here is that on the one hand, we think that, you know, always, if you're wrong, you have a right, you have a moral right to complain, because that, in a sense, almost logically, that's what it means to be wrong. You're wrong. If you're wrong, you can complain. But if then we think about situations where you're wronged and you're just treated the way that, in a sense, you have legislated, because you have said by treating others in these wrong ways, by doing them wrong, you have, as it were, declared that it's okay to do these sort of things. So arguably, you have lost your moral standing to complain. Now, this doesn't mean, and here my suggestion is that we distinguish between what I call constraint and complaint. So we still, if it would be wrong to treat you in some way, then we're not permitted to do it. We shouldn't do it to you. But then the other question is whether you have a right to complain if we actually go and wrong you. And here it's not at all clear. I mean, one example I like is, like, if you think about a professional car thief who steals. That's how he makes his living. I mean, he works hard at stealing other people's car. But then he bought with his own money. He bought a car which he actually loves a great deal, and then somebody steals it. Now, if he gets really angry, getting angry is fine. You don't need to be consistent in your anger. But if you start complaining and saying you resent this morally, and you, how can such things happen? And you expect everybody to have sympathy with you? Then that becomes just hypocritical. That seems like absurd. This shows, I think, that there is a real question here, that the question whether you're wronged or not is not the final answer, not always doesn't always give us the correct reply, or the obvious reply at least, as to whether you may complain morally. And once we start making a difference here, looking at these distinctions, I think there are interesting implications for it, but that would be too complicated here to explain.
Right. So, I mean, another question. If over time we are able to develop social environments where it is easy for people to be morally good, I mean, they can be morally good with little to no effort, would that be a good thing?
Okay, that's a paradox I called morality and moral worth. And I think this is, in a way, some of the paradoxes I'm not too happy about. I mean, because they describe punishment, for example. They describe areas of our life which are unpleasant. Here, I think this is, in a way, a happy paradox. This is was something I call the good absurd. It's perhaps the prime example. There's some other examples, but it's the prime example of what I claim are actually good moral paradoxes, happy moral paradoxes in some sense, but they're still paradoxical. So what is going on here? I think that clearly, morally, we should try to make the world better. I mean, I'm not speaking about how much we should sacrifice in order to do that. That's a different thing. We touched upon that in the paradox of beneficial retirement. I'm just saying, is in a general way, we should try to make the world better. Certainly, we shouldn't try to make the world morally. We shouldn't try to make the world worse. Okay, but the more we succeed, I mean, if we make the world better and better in various ways. For example, we don't have to think about the whole world, but let's think about a society, a well-formed society, where we manage to limit injustice very much. There's no dictatorship. And there's no great injustice, and there's no great poverty, and this is tricky now in these corona days, but we've managed to overcome most health difficulties. And in general, of course, there's individual suffering and etc. But on the social level, most of the evils of human life have been eradicated, have been prevented. Now, this is clearly something that morality should aim for. We should aim for not to have injustice and not to have poverty, great poverty, and et cetera, and suffering as much as we can. But if we achieve it, something odd begins to happen, because then the heights of arguably the heights of moral worth and maybe even of the greatest achievements that human beings are capable of would then be prevented. For example, if there's no dictators to fight against, to struggle against, and actually the government is quite decent, then nobody gains moral worth by struggling against the dictators, because there aren't any. And if there's no great poverty, then there's no wars to fight, or there are no diseases. So, for example, if there are no diseases then that need fighting against, then you don't the doctors and nurses, etc., don't need to risk their lives in order to struggle against them, etc., etc. So you see where the argument is going. So in such a I mean, obviously, we'll never reach a sense of perfection, but in a well-formed, fortunate society like that, I mean, you might think about, I don't know, Denmark or New Zealand or someplace like that. Then there are no, there hardly any room is left for people to reach the heights of moral worth, because they don't have to struggle against evil regimes and resist at evil regimes, and they don't have to struggle against great poverty, and they don't have to struggle against diseases, etc. So in a way, life becomes morally boring, as it were. People would still be pretty good, but most people would be good, but it wouldn't be a great struggle. It would be quite easy to be good. You just can lead your normal life and enjoy life. So obviously, morally, that's something we should aim for. But then, paradoxically, we end up with a situation where nobody reaches the heights of moral worth, because there's no, I mean, we don't need the Martin Luther Kings and the Gandhis and the Sakharovs, etc. We don't need them, because everything is fine socially, on a social level. And the things that aren't fine can be struggled against without risking our lives or without risking our livelihood. And so it's quite easy to become good. And we end up with this, as it were, we all end up being sort of moral couch potatoes. But then, of course, we don't want to go to say, oh, then the solution is that, well, let's just start wars. Or let's have a dictator occasionally, once every few years, let's elect a dictator. So then we can struggle against him or her and achieve the heights of moral worth. I mean, that would be absurd as well. So we end up with a situation which is quite boring, but it is clearly what we should be aiming at. So in a way, the aim of the heights of moral worth are like I picture them as some sort of monster that eats its own tail, because if you succeed in those, then there's no need anymore for people to do these heroic things, because everything's fine. There's no need for heroism.
Since you also do work on free will, I would like to ask you, do free will considerations play a role in any of these moral paradoxes?
And this, I actually consciously decided in my moral paradox, because moral paradox is a book not to consider the free will problem, just because I wanted to put some distance between. I mean, people always thought about me as one of those, the person who does free will, the free will philosopher. But there's actually, this is not in the book, but there's actually at least one paradox that I think is quite interesting that I've uncovered that is connected to free will. So I might, if you want, I might tell you about this.
Sure.
Sure. The idea is it's a paradox about hard determinism, which is let's assume determinism. Let's assume that the world is deterministic for the sake of discussion, whereby everything in the world is there's a cause and effect, and so and once the causes are there, then the results emerge necessarily. This is, of course, the free will problem is, of course, a huge problem. We can't enter it here. And for what it's worth, my position on it is complex. I think there are some senses of free will that exist and some senses not. We won't get into all that. But just for the sake of argument, just to see what's going on, let's assume the most, as it were, skeptical position. Let's assume that, or denialism as it's most often called today. Let's assume that there's no free will in any sense, and there's no moral responsibility. Now, paradoxically, under these situations, if you believe, for example, in that, if you believe in that really strong sense of hard determinism, and you still behave morally very admirably, you still do good, then paradoxically, it seems that you might be most admirable. Because, for example, if I believe that there is free will and moral responsibility, and I believe that I will be held to account for whatever I do, either by other people or even by my conscience, by myself. So I'll feel that, well, I should have done better, I could have done better, I should have behaved more responsibly, and I didn't, so I will blame myself, etc. And so I have a lot of a strong motivation to behave well. But in this story, in this thought experiment we are conducting here, if you believe that no, your moral worth, your blameworthiness or praiseworthiness are not up for consideration, because whatever you do, it will be said that you couldn't have done otherwise because you have no free will or moral responsibility, and you still go on to do good, then you're a better person than me. Now, you might counter and say, yes, but how can somebody be really better or not better if there's no free will? So this is complicated. I won't go into this. I think we need to distinguish between doing good and doing bad and what you deserve for it. But just to simplify, let's assume that you believe false. Let's assume that there is free will and moral responsibility now of some form. But you falsely believe that there's no such free will and moral responsibility, then that under those conditions you would be eligible for the most praise, for the high, because there is free will, so you are eligible to be praiseworthy. But you believe that your moral status is not under examination. That it's you believe that, so you don't have this moral. This further reason that I have, if I believe in free will and moral responsibility, I have this further reason to be good. Where you don't, and you still behave admirably, then you are more praiseworthy than me. For example, we might take an analogy just to see how, to explain how this works. If I believe that God will punish me if I behave hungry, wrongly, and then I behave well, then and you believe that, let's say you believe that there's no God, so you don't believe that you'll be punished by God, and you still behave just as good, just as fine as, a way as I do, then you are more deserving because you don't have that further motivation. Because you don't fear God. It's not because of God, it's because of yourself. You're just a good person in yourself. So I take this form of argument and push it further. And then absurdly, it ends up that the way in which people would end up with the most, being most praiseworthy, is if there is free will and moral responsibility, but they falsely believe that there isn't free will and moral responsibility, and they still nevertheless behave well. So that's a free will paradox.
Mm-hmm. So I have one final question here. In your work, you propose a moral theory, which you call designer ethics, and I'm just going to quote you here. I propose and explore a radical alternative normative moral theory, designer ethics, according to which our views are pro tanto crucial determinants of how morally we ought to be treated. For example, since utilitarians are more sympathetic to the idea that human beings may be sacrificed for the greater good, perhaps it is permissible, or even under certain conditions, obligatory to give them priority as potential victims. So could you elaborate on that?
Sure. This is my most recent work, which is like the work on moral paradoxes, has this general feature of what I might call crazy ethics. But here specifically, it's not necessarily a paradox. The idea is this: it's a recent paper that's come out actually this year, called "Should We Sacrifice the Utilitarians First?" And it's not necessarily about utilitarians. It's about it's a novel thought, might well be misguided, but about morality. And the idea is simple. The idea is that if, for example, we take the classic situation where there are five people. There's a trolley problem, the famous trolley problem. There's a trolley that's going to run over an innocent person. We might turn it so that we can't stop it, but we might turn it so that it would run over five innocent people, one innocent people instead of the five innocent people. And should we do it? And then, for example, utilitarians will clearly say that, yes, we are permitted to sacrifice one person in order to save five other people. And then some other people would say, no, we're not. I mean, we're not actually, we can't play God, as it were. We can't say that we should sacrifice some person in order to save other people. For example, we would never say that we can use people, just take somebody and kill him and use his organs in order to save five other people. Although the five is more than one, but still we're not permitted to do that. So there's all these classical moral dilemmas. And I suggest that actually there's another option that, as far as I know, has never been considered philosophically. And that's the option of saying, well, it depends who the people are and what do they believe. So if in this example, the troll, for example, in the classic trolley problem situation, if you're a utilitarian, then, and you believe that actually people should be sacrificed for the greater good, it's permissible to do this, and you're in that situation, then it applies to you. You should be ready to live according to the beliefs that you think should apply to other people. This, you can see the connection here with moral complaint. I mean, it's a development of my thought from that paradox, I think. On the other hand, if you think that people should never you should never sacrifice other people for the greater good. If you happen to be on the wrong side of the track, literally here, then you should be ready not to have other people sacrificed for your sake. And of course, it applies also to many other situations. So the idea is very, very surprising. And most people say, well, that is crazy. So we don't really, so it's permissible to, and sometimes it's permissible to sacrifice your people. Sometimes it's not permissible. And it depends on what those people believe. That seems absurd. But as we know already with all our paradoxes, the fact that something initially seems absurd doesn't mean that it might still be plausible and might be a convincing moral position. And I think that's the case. At least I think it requires a hearing. So in that way, the reason why I call it designer ethics is because in a sense you design the way that others will treat you on the basis of the moral positions that you yourself put forth. So if you argue that we should treat people in certain ways, you should be ready to suffer the consequences if the carousel turns and it ends, you end up being on the wrong side. So in a way, morality would not be universal in the sense that everybody should be treated equally, but it has some advantage, and this seems, of course, it's quite a significant result, but I think that we gain various things. We gain, for example, that people will, when you put forward your moral beliefs, you will not be a hypocrite, and you will not be run afoul of the idea of moral complaint, and you will be consistent in some sense. Basically, people will take their moral beliefs much more seriously if they think that those specific beliefs would be applied to them, or might be applied to them. So it's I think it's clearly a radical idea. And it might not work, it might not be convincing, it certainly has problems, but then all other normative ethical theories also have significant problems. So I think it's certainly worth a hearing. And one of the things I think one more thing, if I might say, connecting the moral paradoxes in this more recent work, is that moral philosophy is just really exciting. Philosophy in general is very exciting, and moral philosophy also deals with people's lives and with the meaning of life and how we treat other people and on very serious matters. So, but it's also a lot of fun, and there's also, I think, many discoveries still to be made. I think we don't understand many things. We do understand a lot of things, but we don't understand many things. I think the parts we don't understand are greater than most people, even most philosophers, more philosophers think. And we should dare to think and to open up new areas of doubt and try to think and become wiser about them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So let's end on that note. I will be leaving links in the description box to your books, including the one we've been focusing on today, 10 Moral Paradoxes. Are there any places on the internet where people can find you and your work?
Oh, there is. Are we still being recorded?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's a site. www.solzmilansky.com, mm-hmm. And there's some links to most of my papers and some information about myself and this and the sort of curious philosophical things that for some reason I enjoy doing.
Okay, great. So, Saul, thank you again for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Ricardo. Thanks for the invitation. Goodbye.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. Please consider supporting the show. This show depends entirely on your support. So head to patreon.com/thedissenter and consider making a pledge there. Otherwise, I also have links to PayPal in the description box of this interview. This show is brought to you by Enlight's Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons and main supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Peruga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Fordans, Frederick Sunda, Ricardo Vladimir, Craig Healy, Alan McCassell, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Eric Alenia, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Nacio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blyth, Roberto Inguanzo, Michael Stormer, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Omari Hickson, Fergal Cusson, Ivan Bodrenko, Al Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librand, Oslem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Dez Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Miren B., Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevsky, Max Bailby, Nelek Bach, my producers, Izar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafiniak, Ian Gilligan, Sérgio Godriano, Luis Caetano, Tom Vanagdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardis France, and Niruban Balachandran, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, James Pratt, and Matthew Lavender. Thank you for all.